this is the triggering event for colds and flus, is a change in humidity and a change in temperature, very well documented. So well documented that government agencies all around the world can look at meteorological data and predict with almost complete certainty when a pandemic is going to strike within about a month of humidity and temperature reaching certain thresholds.
Greetings and love, beautiful humans. It's Ben Hardy, co-host, and this is Terrain Theory. This week's guest is Daniel Roydas, who just released a book called Can You Catch a Cold? Untold History and Human Experiments. It is instant terrain canon. Daniel has done an incredible job taking a subject rife with complex scientific jargon and presenting it in logical, digestible form. What are flus and colds? What does the actual scientific evidence say about how we quote-unquote catch a cold or a flu? What are the possible alternative explanations for contagion? We were thrilled to have Daniel on to mine for some of the gems within the pages and share the story of how this book came to be and why it matters so much. Yes, we will return to our autism miniseries next week. We simply could not wait to get this conversation out into the world. Hope you enjoy. Welcome back to Terrain Theory. All right, we are rolling. Daniel Roydas, welcome to the Terrain Theory podcast.
Thanks so much for having me, guys. It's a pleasure to finally speak with you both. I've been following your work and really impressed with what you're doing. And I'm, really looking forward to having this conversation with you both.
We are as well. Daniel, let's start, for the sake of the listener who doesn't know you, with a little bit of background.
Yeah, just quickly. I trained as a naturopath in my undergraduate degree, and then went and did various postgraduate qualifications, worked at universities and colleges around the country in Australia for over a decade, and then resigned in 2022 after realizing that the entire natural medicine industry in Australia and probably the world is not what I thought it was, and I resigned myself to the fact that I wasn't going to be able to change anything from the inside, and quit my job and then focused on other avenues, other activities, including writing a book which has just been published, and I'm really glad that that's finally done. That's the easy part done. Now the hard part is actually getting out there and making people aware that it's actually out there.
The podcast book tour, and folks, we would have mentioned it in the intro, but Can You Catch a Cold? Untold History and Human Experiments, just released. I've got my copy in hand. I've been plowing through it in the last couple of days, and we're really excited to dive into it. But before we do, I just wanted to backtrack to one of the points you made about your background, and that was, even within the natural medicine or alternative medicine space, you became disillusioned.
Yeah, I did.
By what exactly?
It is a far cry from what it should be. It's so far removed from being real natural or alternative medicine. It's essentially what they call green pharmacy, which is, I believe it's been infiltrated to align or to integrate with mainstream medicine, to the point where now most clinicians are trained to assess a client clinically, take a bunch of blood tests and functional pathology tests, and then prescribe synthetic toxic supplements to people based on those tests. And it goes very little further than that. It really is so reductionistic and myopic. There is very little of the natural medicine principles being used by clinicians anymore. And the reason I know this is because when I started teaching these principles to students at these colleges and the university I was working at, I got reprimanded for that. So that was the point where I said, I'm not doing this anymore, because it's not allowing me to teach the real stuff to people that need it. And students pay a lot of money for these courses, like $70,000 for a 4-year degree, and come out having basically no understanding of really how to support someone's body to heal itself. So yeah, that's in a nutshell why I became disillusioned and why I had to get out of it.
It's that your perspective, your experience may come as something of a shock to many. It does not come as a shock to me. I've had my own experiences with naturopaths that were really eye-opening. And I went to one with this full body rash, which I've talked about on this podcast before. And I was told that it was probably pityriasis rosea, which if you investigate is potentially virus related or virally caused. Right away, that was a red flag. And then I was told I needed to be on a whole heap of supplements. And I asked, is there a way to address this rash through, say, diet or whatever? And I was told by this naturopath, absolutely not. I can either put you on supplements, like the more natural supplements, or I can give you antibiotics. Those are my two choices from a naturopath. Needless to say, I was very disappointed and have never gone back. And it was, for me, a real eye-opener into what has happened in alternative medicine, and that you really have to be careful. You really have to be cautious, and you really have to vet the person that you're turning to for advice around your health. And really, as Mike and I say, the first person you need to turn to is yourself. That's why we say you are your primary healthcare provider. And folks like you, and with the book that you've released, are empowering people with the knowledge that they can better understand what's happening in their bodies and then be that first responder when things go bad and understand what's happening. So basically, you strip away the delusion, you give proper education and information, and a person can be much clearer about what is happening and then respond appropriately.
That's right. The power has been removed from the individual. The arbiters to health are now considered the clinicians, who have got the expensive degrees and the prescription pads. And the only way that a person can get better is through them, with some fancy test or supplement or drug or procedure or surgery. And there is nothing that the individual can do to heal themselves. This, even in natural medicine now, this is like a foreign concept, essentially, where people are being prescribed hundreds of dollars of expensive, harmful, toxic, synthetic substances, which are claimed to be natural supplements. And they're on them for a long time. And as soon as they stop taking them, the symptoms come back. And there are, people are under the illusion that this is good because it's a natural alternative to drug therapy, when in fact, the people that make the drugs make the vitamins. And yeah, when you really look at this whole thing, it's not reflective of what real natural medicine is, which is basically educating the client about what disease is, all the things the human body needs to thrive, what it doesn't need, and basically educating them on how to remove or minimize their exposure to harmful things, to implement the things that the body does need, and then basically getting out of the way, letting the body do the rest, letting nature heal the body, because it is capable of doing that. It's not rocket science. It's not complicated, it's simple, but unfortunately this has been complicated for a range of different reasons, which, you know, we could do a whole podcast on this, but yeah, it's unfortunate to see it, but it's my mission to get the real information out there to clinicians and health-minded people like yourselves or anyone listening, to give them hope, to motivate them, to inspire them, that your body can heal itself and it's not hard and you don't have to go through a long-winded process of seeing dozens and dozens of clinicians and taking lots of different pills and potions and doing all these different kinds of things. It's really not that complicated.
So the healing part is easy. I say the hard part is the re-education, is the dismantling of the narrative and the story that we've been taught our whole lives. And that brings us to your book. Can You Catch a Cold is the title of the book. So let's start with Daniel. What is a cold?
That's a good question. A cold, from my understanding, can be caused by a range of different things, but essentially any symptom that the body gets is an attempt for the body to return to a state of homeostasis. That's essentially like any symptom, whether it be inflammation, a cough, a sneeze, some mucus, a fever, rhinitis, itchy eyes, whatever those symptoms are, it's essentially the body trying to get itself back into balance because it's been exposed to something which has disrupted that fine balance. It's kind of like dropping a rock into some water. Your body is the water. The ripples are the symptoms, the consequence of the rock being dropped in. And those ripples are essentially the water trying to get back to balance, back to level, back to homeostasis. The symptoms are the ripples in the water. So when you have a cold or a flu, the symptoms are the body's attempt to restore balance, as I said, from whatever you've been exposed to that may take the body out of that state of homeostasis. And there's a range of different things which can cause that. Questionable whether or not one of those things is a pathogen. I would argue that point. But there are many other things which have been demonstrated to cause an imbalance in the body, resulting in these symptoms we define as a cold or flu.
This is the foundational understanding as put forward by someone like Bichamp.
Yeah, and the sanitarian doctors. So the sanitarians were a group of eclectic clinicians in the 1800s, 1900s, early 1900s, who understood this, that the symptoms were the cure. The cold and the flu was the cure. You can't find a cure for the cure, right? There is no cure for the cold because they are you can't find a cure for a cold or flu because those two conditions are the answer to the problem. And we've confused ourselves with what disease is. So we look at colds and flus as a disease, as a problem, as a thing that we need to get rid of, when in fact, it is the body's healing mechanism. And this is true of any disease. So yeah, there aren't thousands of different diseases. There is only one disease. That disease is a thing called allostasis, which is the body in an active response of returning to balance. There's one disease. There aren't thousands. And there aren't thousands of different causes. There's a very few causes, actually. And once people understand this, it takes a lot of the fear out of disease. It takes a lot of the complications and the this long, arduous journey trying to find the answer, trying to find the cure. The answer is staring us in the face. We've known it for a long time. These eclectic doctors knew it. And basically what they did, they were educators. They educated their clients on what they needed to do to get healthy, what they needed to remove from their lifestyle and their diet. And that was as far as it needed to go. They were in the late 1800s, they were at the peak of medicine. I think it all went downhill from there. We look at those guys as living in the dark ages, that they were stupid, they had no understanding. But actually, I think they had refined their understanding about the human body, how it functioned, what disease was, for thousands of years since the work of men like Hippocrates. That's like 500 BC, I think, or 500 AD. Can't remember exactly when he was around, but it was somewhere in that time frame. And that knowledge just got built upon up until the late 1800s, but then it was all dismantled when the germ theory was rolled out.
As we got into this space, started the podcast and started having folks on, it quickly became apparent to us that words matter, definitions matter. Arriving at an agreed upon definition of a word really mattered if you were going to have conversations and try to educate people. And it occurs to us has already occurred to us, but again is made clear once again because of your book, that we just need a different word for cold or flu. Because in the minds of the person, when you say cold, when you say flu, they think of something completely different. It's almost as if we need a different set of language, a different set of words to describe or label what it is that's happening to the body.
Yeah, it's essentially a purge. That's what's going on. It's a purge, or an adaptive response. Our forefathers called them colds and flus for a reason. They defined those, that they gave those conditions, those words, to tell us what the cause of those things was. So they literally named a cold after the symptoms people experience when they're exposed to changes in the weather. So when the weather conditions become colder, they literally put it in the name. And yet we think it's this this mystery, it's this secret that no one can ever unlock. We never really know what is really going on with the cold or flu, because it's highly questionable and doubtful whether or not it's a virus. And then if it's not a virus, then what is it? Well, they named it after the cause, cold. Same with influenza. Influenza was adapted from a guy called John Huxham, and it was the Italian word influenza di freddo, which is influence of the cold, right? It's a change in atmospheric conditions and temperature, which elicits these symptoms. But you're right, these words have been sort of hijacked to make people associate them with being things that aren't associated with weather conditions anymore. They're actually caused by invisible, mysterious particles that float through the air and transmit from person to person, and their sole mission is to make people sick. So, yeah, we've been confused, and all we need to do is just look at what our forefathers put out there and the information that they were that they had accumulated and that they had documented. All the answers to the questions we seek are there. You just got to look back in history, which is what I did in the first part of this book, to unlock these forgotten secrets.
I also like the, I've heard that influenza is derived from influence of the stars, which plays into the esoteric biochemistry understanding of how our bodies work, which I quite like. But you mentioned earlier that you were reprimanded for teaching the real stuff. Could you talk about what some of the real stuff was that you were parlaying to your students?
Yeah, the real stuff is that there is only one disease. The symptoms are the cure. When you have the symptoms, the damage is already done. That there's three causes of disease. There's a deficiency in something, a toxicity in some of something, or a trauma. So physical trauma or an emotional trauma. So when I say deficiency, I'm talking about a lack of real food, a deficiency in sunlight, a deficiency in clean water, fresh air, love, meaning, purpose, connection, physical activity, sleep, rest, enjoyment, pleasure. There's a lack of something in your life that is essential, that you require as a human being to function. Then there's the opposite to that, the other end, which is a toxicity. So maybe too much sunlight, too much water, too much exercise, too much love. I don't know if that's a thing, but maybe it is. a toxicity in fake junk food, right, which isn't really food anyway. So there's a deficiency, a toxicity, and all you really need to do is be a real doctor. And what that means is teacher. And if you're a teacher, it means that the curriculum has already been written. The knowledge is already there. You're just imparting that knowledge onto other people. So the causes of disease aren't a mystery. What disease is isn't a mystery. And how to support the body to heal itself isn't a mystery either. We already know all these things. Our forefathers had the answers to this stuff in the late 1800s. And that is all they did with their clients, was educate, 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 educate. And once they understood this stuff, they could then take that information and change their diet and lifestyle in such a way that their body healed itself. There are fundamental principles in naturopathic medicine. And they are things like doctor is teacher, the healing power of nature, holism, right? I think there's 6 or 7 of these principles. And if you actually follow them and understand what they really mean, it becomes immediately apparent that health isn't confusing. It's not meant to be hard. It's simple. It's easy. Anyone can do it. The body does it itself. Only you can heal your body. It's not anyone else that can do it for you. And you hold the power. No one else holds that power. And these are the fundamental concepts that I was trying to get across to students. And some of them loved it, others didn't. And it ended up, as I said, me resigning because they thought that this stuff was a bit too woo-woo and I was teaching outside of the curriculum, which was essentially work with a diagnosis that's been given by a medical doctor, do your functional test, and then prescribe based on that test, which it has nothing to do with any of the natural medicine principles whatsoever.
And it's prescribing to suppress symptoms, which is the allopathic model. What's funny is that you were teaching terrain theory. I mean, those are our three pillars that we talk about all the time: toxicity, deficiency, stress, and trauma. And Tom Cowan recently added delusion, which potentially could be under the trauma banner. But so, who are some of the forefathers that you keep mentioning in the late 1800s? What are some of those names?
Well, people like Henry Linlar, for one, is like one of the fathers of naturopathic medicine. Obviously, we've got people like Bechamp, right, and Claude Bernard, and the eclectic or sanitarian medical doctors who really pioneered this stuff. Walter B. Cannon, who took Claude Bernard's concept of the terrain and turned it into a thing called homeostasis, which we all have some understanding of, and it's fairly well accepted in mainstream medicine, this idea of homeostasis. But it's downplayed. It's just seen as this thing that's kind of in the background. It is important to know about, but drugs and surgery and these other interventions are more important than really understanding what homeostasis is and how to support the body's innate healing capacity to achieve balance and to achieve homeostasis. So, these are some of the forefathers that I'm referring to.
Yeah, thanks. One thing I wanted to make sure I got into this conversation, so I might as well do it now. So I just got back from a trip down to Florida with my family. And when we left for the trip, my son had some conjunctivitis, pink eye, that he, quote unquote, got from his girlfriend. And of course, me, Mr. Terrain Theory, is like, well, you know, I don't believe in contagion, so I'm not worried about that. And lo and behold, a week later, I have this whopping case of, you know, I'm having an adaptive response in my eyeballs. And it's been really interesting trying to really look at this process through the terrain lens. And what I've come up with, and I'd want to hear what you guys think, is that our eyes are under quite a lot of stress, especially in the technological era that we live in, with screens for one thing. But even just reading, and I mean, our eyeballs, it's funny when your eyes are compromised, you realize like how much you rely on your eyes for a sense of reality, normalcy. You can't get through the day with any sort of ease if your eyes are irritated, because they're just literally omnipresent. It's how we filter the world. So I've decided that the majority of people are under quite a lot of eye stress. And so when somebody expresses symptoms of detox, conjunctivitis, that it's obviously not a boogeyman jumping from eye to eye, that it's the body saying, oh, this would be a good idea for me to do too. I should probably purge whatever's going on, whatever dead material has accumulated in my eyes, and start this process. You know, like I said, now my daughter has it. So it's really challenging to try and impart the principles and lessons of terrain theory and questioning the mechanisms of quote unquote contagion when it goes from person to person to person to person. And the school says, well, you can't come back to school till you get this pharmaceutical eye drop put in, and because they just want to smash the symptoms. But so I'm trying to honor the process and look at this as an upgrade and a cleaning to my eyes. But it's really funny because, again, I'm a musician. I had shows this last weekend. It's really awkward being in front of an audience with these swollen eyes and then doing the meet and greet at the merch table and people sort of like recoiling from you a little bit, respectfully, but like it's just so ingrained in the culture. Like, you have pink eye. That's really contagious. You probably got it, poor you, because you're around people all the time doing these shows. You must have got it from somebody. To break that narrative it's just such a deep one, especially with this one, because it's not a cold or a flu. It's pink eye. And it's just a nice reminder that everyone in the culture says, you have pink eye. That's really contagious.
Do all three of you live in the same house?
Yeah. Yeah. My kids are still in the house. They're young.
My immediate thought is, we are exposed to so many other common environmental factors. So there may have been something in the air, for example, that has irritated all of your eyes. And it just seems like it's spreading between you. I'm not trying to discount what you're saying, but
no, I want to tease it out because I'm trying to tease it out myself. So go for it.
My immediate, like they thought, Mike, that conditions like beriberi and scurvy and these nutritional deficiency diseases were contagious because people fell ill with the same symptoms one after the other. And you look in the old medical literature and they were convinced that beriberi was a contagious disease. They were utterly convinced of it. But they could never prove it because obviously it's not a contagious illness. So there are things that seem to be contagious or seem to spread. And like even in the book, in one of the early chapters, I talk about how there was a young family of two sisters and a brother who were admitted to a emergency room department with these symptoms which were diagnosed as strep throat and scarlet fever. And the medical doctors in the emergency room said, look, this is a contagious childhood illness. It's spread amongst the siblings in the house. Here's some antibiotics. Take them home. Let them rest. They'll be fine. Anyway, a few days later, their symptoms got really bad. They started becoming, they developed neurological conditions, neurological symptoms. Mother took them to another emergency department, and it turned out that they were playing with a vial of mercury, which dropped on the carpet, and the mother came along with a vacuum, vacuumed it up, and it aerosolized the mercury into the air. And the young children, obviously they're smaller, their body size is smaller, so the dose of mercury they were exposed to was enough to cause toxicity. But the mother, obviously being larger in size, her body could compensate and buffer for that same exposure. So she didn't get symptoms, which is why the doctor said this is a contagious childhood illness. But they soon found out that it was mercury poisoning. So there was a common environmental exposure to something that was missed by the initial doctors. They thought it was contagious, seemed like it was contagious, but in fact it wasn't. So there may be other reasons for this. There may be something in your HVAC system. There may be something, a change in the temperature and the humidity in the area that you live in. They even spoke about this in some of the old medical journals, where on one side of a street or on one side of a stream, people living in the houses on either side would get the symptoms of this disease, but the other side of the road or the house were completely unaffected. And the doctors at the time went and measured air temperature and humidity levels. And I guess these were pretty primitive ways of measuring those things back then. But they noticed that even within very short distances of a couple of meters, there were drastic differences in these atmospheric conditions, enough to elicit these physiological responses and cause symptoms in people. So it seemed like it was spreading, but it actually wasn't. And it seemed like the people on one side of the road were immune and the people on the other side weren't, but it had nothing to do with that. So, I think there may be other explanations for this. There's also like sympathetic responses and nocebo effects and social contagion and all these other kinds of things that might go some length to explaining these phenomena that we've observed. I don't know if that helps at all, but this is just sort of where my mind's immediately going when you're relaying this story that's happened to you recently.
Yeah, no, it's, again, because we're so steeped in the terrain model, it's good to hold ourselves up under the microscope and try and tease out what's going on. But it's difficult to counter the cultural narrative, especially, you know, within the family. And like I said, having to talk to different fans and to see it like up close and personal like that has been a nice reminder of how much work we have to do still.
Well, it's interesting. I'm almost certain that during my research for this book, I found papers where they were trying to transmit conjunctivitis between people and they couldn't do it, which is really interesting. So it brings into question this concept of when I touch a mucosal surface or I have something on my hands and I touch another person's mucosa, that I can transmit something to them. Like, they tried doing this and they couldn't do it, which sort of, it makes it difficult to reconcile because we think we see this effect happening and we immediately attribute it to a contagious illness because that is a story we've been told. That is the only story that we've been told for our entire lives. So some of us who have been told that these things are contagious for 50, 60 years, we just believe it because people in authority told us that that was it. We've only ever had one explanation to explain the phenomena and no one's ever challenged it. No one's ever come along and said, actually, there are other explanations, plausible explanations that might explain why you're getting sick. And if we are given access to all of those different possibilities from childhood, then that becomes our reality. We can take that forward with us for the rest of our life. So when something happens, we go, oh, it could be this, 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 or this. But currently, the paradigm that we're all trapped in, or some of us are breaking out of it, is that there's only one thing that causes this stuff. And it's no wonder why it's so difficult to think outside of the box when it comes to these phenomena that we observe.
Part of the challenge is we've acknowledged, and folks like you have acknowledged, is that you're also breaking people out of a victim mindset and asking that they take accountability. That maybe environmental exposure, some of those things you can limit, some of them as you enter into the world and go through different buildings, you're just going to be exposed to. But things that you eat, that's a choice that you make. Your lifestyle, these are choices that you make. And it can be challenging to get people into that mindset, to break out of victim mindset and into, no, you're actually in control here.
I agree. It is this victim mentality that it was a germ or something out there. But I think we've been trained to respond that way because, look, around the same time that germ theory came out, plastics were being invented, pesticides were starting to be sprayed on food, there was a lot of petrochemicals starting to be used for various different purposes. There was various electromagnetic frequencies and electricity and like all sorts of things. Industries and warehouses were burning fossil fuels and polluting the air. Like there was all these things happening around this time. And it's maybe a coincidence that germ theory was released around this same time. Because if germ theory wasn't released at that time and people started getting sick, they would have said, hey, it's probably these microplastics or these plastics in our food or the poison you're spraying on our food and putting into our water supply. I think germ theory has been basically used as a red herring. Mm-hmm. So in one aspect, yeah, there is this victim mentality perspective, but also that we've been tricked to think that the symptoms caused by the body detoxifying from these poisons, which we don't really have much of a control over because they're being used by basically every single industry, these things that we're all being exposed to in our environment, in our water, in our food, clothes, air, in our cars, basically everywhere, the diseases associated with exposure to those things are caused by germs. Mm. Yeah, because again, this is a story that we're told. So germs are being used as a scapegoat, as a red herring for a deeper underlying problem that we don't have any control over. And people don't look to those things as causes of disease because they're downplayed in the shadow of the overarching germ theory. So I think once people realize that it isn't a germ making them sick, their attention is going to go to the things that really are making them sick. And we can get rid of a lot of those things that are being put into our environment. And we eliminate this thing that we don't have control over, which is making us sick. And then once that's out of the way, I think then most of illness that we see would be down to the individual. But even in saying that, there are many things that can be done to keep yourself healthy in the face of being exposed to those things. So you can definitely be more susceptible to being adversely affected by poison in your food and water in your air if you're doing all of the wrong things compared to someone who's doing all of the right things.
So step one, as you mentioned, is dismantling germ theory. And this is what you do in your book. You divide your book into three sections. And so we want to hit, I'd love to hit on a few of the highlights of each section. Part one, you focus on these foundational and historical misconceptions and specifically demonstrating how germ theory is inadequate. And you have two points that I'd love to hammer on. And one is that it fails to meet the criteria of Koch's postulates. And then two, it fails to adhere to the scientific method. And that'll sound familiar to some of our longtime listeners, but as we've said that the key to adult learning is repetition, maybe you could walk through 2 points in the book.
Yeah. Those are very important points. So the Koch's postulates were devised as a means for proving a cause and effect relationship between a germ and a disease. So the claim was that X germ causes Y disease when X germ infects a healthy host. It infects healthy tissue, destroys it, and causes disease. And Koch devised these postulates, which are outlined in the book and they're readily available and on the internet, anyone can find these postulates. But no sooner had he devised these postulates that he wasn't able to fulfill them with things like tuberculosis and cholera. So very shortly after he made these postulates, he couldn't fulfill them himself, and neither could other doctors and scientists trying to demonstrate that germs cause infectious disease. So he modified them almost immediately in a way that allowed germs to satisfy the modified postulates rather than the original ones he devised. And he said it was because the original postulates weren't satisfactory to prove a cause and effect relationship. He had done something wrong in devising these postulates. But if you look at what they say, they're actually a sound process of demonstrating a cause and effect relationship. It's just that the underlying theory about germ theory was wrong. So his postulates are fine. They are great. It's the concept It's the fundamental things further upstream with the germ theory itself, which are the problem.
So let's continue then. So germ theory fails to adhere to the scientific method, and you explore virology and isolation of viruses. So tell us how it fails to adhere to the scientific method.
Yeah, well, the scientific method is, again, a way of demonstrating cause and effect or establishing a cause and effect relationship that a germ causes disease. And to do this, to fulfill the scientific method, you do a scientific experiment. And within a scientific experiment, you have an independent variable and a dependent variable. And you manipulate your independent variable. You manipulate your independent variable to see the effect on the dependent variable. And this has never been done in the field of bacteriology or virology, because there is no independent variable. There's never been an independent variable, which would be a virus. So you have to have the thing that you want to investigate. You have to establish that that thing actually exists in nature first, to show that it has the effect that you hypothesize. To really simplify this down, because it can confuse people, virologists say they have an independent variable, which is a virus, but they have to use a cell culture to get that independent variable. Now, there's a problem with that, because they claim that viruses are existing in nature. Yet, if you're going to use a cell culture, you have to control for each step along the way in the cell culture to prove that none of your methods or the procedures or ingredients and things that you've used along the way have confounded the end result. So have your methods and procedures been controlled in a manner to show that the thing that you're ending up with, the end result, was the same as what was in the snot of a person before you started doing the cell culture. So you have to show that the virus exists in the mucus first, and only then can you start doing your cell cultures and arrive at an end result and say, here's the virus, we've just grown it in, and it's increased in number. They haven't done that. It's kind of like a baker saying chocolate cakes exist in nature. And what the baker does is he adds lots of different ingredients together in a mixing bowl, puts it in an oven on a high temperature, and then after 90 minutes, he pulls it out and there's a chocolate cake, and he says, see, chocolate cakes do exist in nature. This is what scientists like virologists are doing in labs. They're essentially mixing a bunch of ingredients together and getting an end result, a chocolate cake, and then claiming that end result exists in nature, but they've never shown the chocolate cake anywhere in nature to begin with. So this is a real problem. Without doing that, you then can't start using chocolate cakes in a scientific experiment and make claims about what this chocolate cake does in nature. That chocolate cakes in nature make people fat, right? In the Amazon, the reason why people get obese 100 years ago was because they were eating too many chocolate cakes that came from chocolate cake trees. So you got to show the chocolate cake exists in nature first. Oh, no, but we are showing it. You got to follow these steps first, and then you get the chocolate cake. And this is how we prove that it exists in nature. So it's like logically fallacious, this reasoning. This is essentially what's going on in the field, not only of virology, but I think a lot of chemistry, actually, even things like nutritional medicine, nutritional science is also plagued with these problems where they're not controlling their experiments and proving the thing that they're looking for exists in nature first. So yeah, there's many issues with this.
And it dawns on me that then what you need to do is take an attenuated version of the chocolate cake and inject it into a person so that they could be immune to chocolate cake and then they won't get fat.
Yeah, look, You have to establish that the thing you're trying to use as an independent variable in your experiment exists in nature first.
Correct.
You have to go and demonstrate beyond all reasonable doubt that it exists. That hasn't been done. And anyone who's intellectually honest, who looks at the methodologies of these virology experiments, can see that. Now, in this book, I wanted to make sure that I was dotting all my I's and crossing all my T's. And I actually approached a virologist and microbiologist and asked them to review and critique my work. And I did that to make sure that the information that I was putting out there was accurate. So it's not that I've just gone out there and put this information there without any due diligence. Many people can see these fundamental flaws, but very few are willing to speak out for obvious reasons. Because once you do that, and you draw attention to these problems with the fundamental underlying principles of things like virology, then the whole house of cards will soon come crumbling down. And like, I don't think that's ever going to happen. I don't think they're ever going to turn around and go, actually, you know what? We got it wrong. Sorry, guys. We just made a mistake and we asked for forgiveness and now we're going to do proper science. I think there's been too much damage that's happened for them to actually admit to this and say, right, we made a mistake. So all that we can do is put that information out there in books like this, and people with the ears to hear the information, eyes to see it, will accept it. Many people will read it and they won't understand it, they won't get it, and that's okay. The information is not for them. They're not ready yet.
I realized how challenging it was going to be to open the eyes of the world to some of the truths that you offer in this book. When I had a naturopath, a person who's close to me, essentially refused to look into this idea that pathogenic viruses have never been proven to exist, because, and this was a direct quote, she said, "I treat patients with antivirals. This would be career suicide." And this is someone who I have immense respect for, who I think got into naturopathic medicine for all the right reasons, who I think is an inquisitive, curious person. But to this, it was like the blinders were put on and kept on willingly. And I think, and that was a real eye opener to me, that because of the investment that so many have made in their education to take on this profession, and because it is their profession and their livelihood depends on it, they can't imagine a world where they could continue doing what they do without the presence of a germ to treat and cure and provide supplements for, et cetera, et cetera. Or the fear of becoming an outcast within those circles is too great. And therefore, they're just gonna stay in this lane. So you know, credit to you for putting this together. We still have work to do to get people to read it.
Yeah, we got a lot of. Well, yeah, we do have our work cut out for us, but I think we just stay focused on the task at hand, and we keep doing what we are doing. And those, as I said, who are ready and willing to see it and listen, will. Those who aren't, won't. And I think career suicide for some people, but again, they're giving a herb that they're told is antiviral and someone gets better when said herb is given. Again, they're just observing an effect. It's like this logical fallacy, assuming the subsequent logical fallacy, right? You see this effect and then you assume the cause. It's like this backwards logic that I was told my entire career that St. John's wort was antiviral. I give it to people with viral illnesses and they get better, so it must mean that there's a virus. But it could be having all kinds of other effects in the body that aren't having to do with anything to do with a virus. But the other thing, Ben, as well, is that it may be a self-preservation mechanism or a self-protection mechanism where if they were to accept this fact that germ theory is not correct, that opens up Pandora's box then, And it means that many other things in this world that they have believed to be true are also incorrect. And that's a big, scary world when there's all these unanswered questions. And maybe someone's been lying to me, and then why would they lie? And oh my God, what's really going on in this world? And what am I here for? Like, it opens up so many other things to think about, and they're not ready to do that. So that's okay. When they're ready, when it's time, they will. We can try to say things in all kinds of different ways and use analogies and put things in to books and podcasts and videos and whatever else. But those people aren't going to listen. It doesn't matter what you say, how you say it, where you say it, they will remain fixed in their belief. And yeah, I think over time, this idea will gain more and more traction. The more and more people look at it, and the more people talk about it, and the more people hear about it, then perceptions and perspectives will start to shift. You have to remember that before 2020, we're only talking 4 years ago here, basically no one on the face of the planet, like, would it even have been a point of a percentage of the entire world's population question germ theory? Now I think we've actually got maybe a few percentage points of people in the world. It's a growing number, and it's just going to grow steadily. Now the cat's out of the bag. We're going to reach the tipping point eventually, that critical mass point. It's not far off. Is it 5 years? Is it 10 years? I don't know. But how we get there is by doing what we're doing right now.
One of my favorite quotes, again, to reference Tom Cowan, is virology is a gateway drug, which has proved to be quite true. Because once you, like you said, once you start questioning this, what else is manipulated out there that I've sort of built my worldview around? And it turns out it's quite a lot. Could you get into some of the temperature you mentioned in your book about the as an environmental cause? I've also heard people talk about this as a contributing factor, or maybe the factor for things like malaria, when you go from a northern climate to a southern climate and express symptoms. Let's get into that a little bit.
Yeah, this is the triggering event for colds and flus, is a change in humidity and a change in temperature. Very well documented. So well documented that government agencies all around the world can look at meteorological data and predict with almost complete certainty when a pandemic is going to strike, within about a month of humidity and temperature reaching certain thresholds. So how this may actually work is our respiratory tract is lined full of cells, supposedly, that have these finger-like projections on the cells called cilia. And they're like little brooms, thousands and thousands of these little cilia on a single cell. So you have billions, trillions of these little cilia all throughout your respiratory tract. As you inhale particulate matter in the air, those cilia, which are like little brooms, brush that stuff up and out of your respiratory tract. Keeps it clean. They're like street sweepers. Now, when there's a change in temperature or humidity below or past a certain threshold, the inhalation of that air inhibits the activity of those cilia. So they can't remove the particulate matter out of your respiratory tract anymore. So you start to accumulate this particulate matter inside your respiratory tract, in your lungs and in your nose and throat. And what actually happens is the body then has to find another way to clear this stuff out. So what it does is it starts to slough off all of the cells that line your respiratory tract and induces an inflammatory response, which causes coughing, mucus production, sneezing, a fever, runny nose, mucus production, to expel this stuff out of your respiratory tract. And these are the symptoms we associate with a cold or flu. So this is, again, well documented in the literature. They know that this actually happens. It's not some theoretical concept. It's actually a known physiological response. Now, interestingly enough, when there are changes in humidity and temperature, there are also changes in particulate matter that are suspended in the atmosphere. So we're talking about PM2.5, PM like particulate matter, which is 2.5 microns or smaller, PM10, which is particulate matter that's 10 microns or smaller, levels of ozone, levels of sulfurous oxide, nitrous oxide, sulfurous acid, nitric acid. There's a range of different atmospheric compounds that their concentrations change considerably when there's a change in humidity and temperature. Now, inhalation of some of these compounds also inhibits this mucociliary clearance, what I was talking about before, the brooms in your airway working. They also cause damage to the tissue, chemical damage to the tissue in your lungs. And then the body has to remove that damaged tissue, clear it out, and repair it. Does that by coughing, sneezing, and producing mucus. And then there's also just the act of breathing in cool air, because that dries out the mucociliary response, or dries out the mucus and impairs the mucociliary response. So then your lungs start to clog up with stuff in the air. So there's this side of things, but also when there's changes in humidity and temperature, you also get things happening like temperature inversions. So in 2019, when people in Wuhan started getting these symptoms of, they call it COVID-19. Don't know if we can say that here. What actually happened was a temperature inversion over a large part of China. So usually what happens is heat from the sun warms the ground, and the layer of air closest to the ground becomes heated, and hot air rises, and it takes the pollution up and away from the lower-lying areas. But when there's a change in temperature and humidity, you get a temperature inversion, and a cool layer of air acts as a lid, stopping that hot air from rising up and taking away the particulate matter. Now, when that happens, you get a buildup of PM2.5 to levels which are extremely harmful to human health. So the currently accepted level of PM2.5 is five parts per million. It might be 5 micrograms per cubic meter. Very low level. And actually, no country in the world achieved these levels as of 2020. Now, across China, in late 2019, early 2020, when this temperature inversion happened, the levels of particulate matter went up to, in some areas, more than 700 parts per million, right? So people are literally walking around in a toxic atmosphere, breathing in all this stuff into their lungs, which they can't get rid of because their mucociliary clearance has been impaired because of the change in temperature. So you're literally, your body is just inhaling all this gunk. So the body says, right, we've got to find another way to clear it out. So you get this response that we call a cold or flu. This is a meteorological cause. No pathogen involved. Well established.
I never heard that layer to it, that when there's a change in atmospheric conditions, that it can cause a buildup of pollution in the air. I mean, I guess at some level that's self-evident, but I never heard it put the way you just put it. So thank you for that.
if people are interested in seeing a visual representation of how this actually works, there is a video on YouTube where they did this. They demonstrated the effects of a change in absolute humidity on the mucociliary clearance in, I think it was sheep's respiratory tracts. I'll just pull up the video because you can actually see the mucociliary change happen in real time. The video is only maybe a couple of minutes long. So if people at home wanted to, you can literally type this in. If you're listening, I guess we won't show it here, but you type in comparison of mucus clearance at 100% and 90% humidity. It's by Fisher and Paykel Healthcare. And it shows this in real time. So it's a great visual way of seeing what actually goes on inside our lungs and how this activity is inhibited when there's a change in things like humidity.
In other words, when it gets cold, you can catch a cold.
Yeah.
Yeah. So all the mothers who are admonishing their kids for running outside without a jacket on were right all along.
Yeah, and look, virology just poo-poos this. They say that what actually happens is that when there's a change in humidity, virus particles more readily adhere to particulate matter in the air. There's more virus particles in the air. And the cool, dry air dries out your respiratory tract mucus and makes you more susceptible to catching a virus. Yet no one has ever empirically demonstrated or observed a virus particle adhering to a water droplet in the air. No one's ever done that. No one's ever seen a virus go into a respiratory tract and infect a cell and do what they claim. But people have observed mucociliary changes in real time when the humidity and temperature changes.
It's interesting. Early on, Ben and I were listening to a lot of Zach Bush, who I still love and admire, but that was actually one of the postulates he put forward, Ben. And this has to do with the fires in Australia at the time that were massive, right? And that he put forth that in New York City, the virus particles were catching a ride on the particulate matter caused by the Australian wildfires. That was, yeah, which at this point seems absolutely absurd. But at the time, I was like, okay, well, I didn't know what I know now. It seemed kind of reasonable.
It's a great story.
It's a great story.
and yet, you don't need the virus particles. You just need the PM 2.5 from the bushfires, basically moving all over the world and straight up to China, hovering there and then being prevented from rising up in the atmosphere away from humans.
Just to put what I was saying about before about this particulate matter in the air, let's putting this into perspective for people. If you live in Beijing, spending 24 hours there, is the air quality is so bad, 24 hours there is the equivalent of smoking 50 cigarettes.
Wow.
So there's people walking, and this is when there's not a temperature inversion. Yeah. So the air quality might be like 200 or 300 parts per million. Then it goes up to 700 for a period of a few days to a week, sometimes longer. So you might be smoking the equivalent of like 3 to 4 packets of cigarettes, and people get respiratory tract symptoms and we wonder why. And then we say, oh, it's because the virus adheres to the particles, and then it's like you're smoking the equivalent of 4 packs of cigarettes. The particulate matter in the air is known to be one of the most damaging things to human health on the face of the planet. PM2.5, one of the most destructive things a human being can be exposed to. Yet when this happens, we just discount it as nothing. It's not an important factor in disease. It's the viruses that are adhering to the particles that are the cause. So again, it's kind of like this red herring fallacy.
Four packs of cigarettes and they don't even get the nicotine hit. I would be pissed. Daniel, so Mike asked a question that took us to part three, which is, you know, the temperature, getting into the changes in temperature and humidity as a cause of what we call a cold or a flu or respiratory, I'm even now pronouncing the word like an Australian, respiratory distress. This is the effect that you're having on us, Daniel. I'm going to start talking like an Aussie. But we skip part two, and I want to just jump back real quickly in the time we have remaining, because I think you do a great job in part two of exploring contagions and the studies that have been done on contagions to provide evidence to prove contagion, but failed. And in particular, you look at some of the peculiarities of the Spanish flu, as well as some of the studies that were conducted to that period. What did you discover?
The claim is that when a sick person comes in contact with a healthy person, they transmit their illness to them via a infectious particle in the mucus of their respiratory tract through a cough, a sneeze, or a fomite. So you touch some snot, some mucus, you touch an object, that person touches the object and infects himself. Yet when scientists and doctors tried to demonstrate this phenomena, they failed every single time. There were some instances where people got sick, but they never proved that it was because of contagion. They did all kinds of things where they were taking snot from sick people and injecting it into healthy people, subcutaneously, intravenously. They inoculated into their noses and throats. And I think in the summary or the appendix of the book, I give a analysis of all the experiments that I looked at, which was over 200. And the modal contagion rate, so when we're talking about mode, we're talking about the most frequently occurring result, is a modal contagion rate of zero. So what that means is, if you were to conduct an experiment where you put healthy people and sick people in a room together, the most likely result that you would get is no contagion. Basically everything was done to try and make healthy people sick. They couldn't do it. And this flies directly in the face of this claim that if you simply walk past a person who's got a cold or a flu and they cough or sneeze in your presence, this fleeting contact will lead you to catch their germs and you get sick. Yet in these optimal conditions, they couldn't demonstrate it. So this is empirical evidence. Yeah, if the claim was true, you should be able to do that experiment and simply observe all these people catching a cold. There were instances where they took mucus from sick people and inoculated it into the respiratory tracts, noses, throats, eyes of healthy people, and they got symptoms. But that doesn't necessarily mean it was because of a contagious flu virus or a pathogen. And actually what they found is that when you get symptoms of a cold or flu, those symptoms are caused by an increase in inflammatory markers or mediators in your snot, like bradykinin and histamine and the like. They increase by up to 30 times, and they have exposed people to isolated, concentrated levels of bradykinin and these other prostaglandins or inflammatory mediators. And lo and behold, it induces colds and flus. Cough, sneeze, sore throat, runny eyes, temperature. So it's possible that when people were getting exposed to this sick person's mucus, the sheer concentration of inflammatory mediators in that mucus made them sick. It could also be because they believed that they were going to get sick, It could also be from an allergic response. It could be from a chemical irritation to the mucous membranes. And it could also be from physical irritation of directly having something shoved up your nose and squirted in there. So even in the very few instances where people did get sick, they never proved that it was a virus, and they never disproved that it wasn't any of those other things that I've mentioned.
What else did you learn about the Spanish flu?
Yeah, very interesting. Like, we're under the impression that 100 to 500 million people died, yet in the medical literature, doctors and scientists at the time were reporting a curious absence or lack of sick people. So people were just going about their daily activities, and doctors were sitting around their offices not doing a whole lot. And they were writing in their medical journals how interesting and peculiar it was that during the world's most deadly pandemic, they weren't seeing a single patient. There were other doctors who said that they weren't seeing any people with Spanish flu, but they were seeing lots of people with cholera and yellow fever and these other conditions, and they thought there must be multiple pandemics occurring at the same time. So what that means possibly is that everything was being branded as Spanish flu. There was all sorts of common illnesses occurring, and they were all just being rebranded, similar to possibly what happened in 2020. They haven't really changed their playbook very much since then. But one thing that really stood out to me was that at that time in history, there was the Great War going on, World War One, and a vast number of young men went to fight on battlefields in Europe, and they were exposed to chemical warfare agents. Now, it just so happens that one of those chemical warfare agents, phosgene gas, causes symptoms identical to what was being classified as Spanish flu. And if you look at the symptoms of Spanish flu, there were four different types. One of those types, and this was the type that affected young men between the ages of 20 to 40 years of age, mainly soldiers, surprisingly, was this physic form of Spanish flu, which means that you had bleeding from the eyes, ears, mouth, nose. Your body turned a dark black color. Your body smelt of musty hay or straw. You had right-sided heart failure, and you could be fine that morning, walking around perfectly healthy, and 2 hours later, be gasping for air as you basically dropped dead. Now, what's really interesting is that those symptoms are identical to phosgene gas poisoning. And surgeons and medical doctors at the time who were conducting autopsies wrote in the medical literature how surprised they were to see that gas poisoning victims, their lung tissue was indistinguishable from that of people who died of Spanish flu. So I'm not saying that what we're seeing there was a misdiagnosis of Spanish flu as gas poisoning, but it's just really interesting that at the same point in history, when hundreds of thousands of tons of poison gas were being deployed all across the world, people were dying of the same symptoms of a completely unrelated disease. It's maybe just a coincidence. I don't know.
It's uncanny. It's not unlike DDT being sprayed all over our farmland and polio following in its wake, correct?
Yeah, it's another just uncanny coincidence. And another uncanny coincidence is like people would say, well, if it was really gas poisoning, how did it affect like cities all around the world or across the world? There are reports in the news and by the military that there were German boats sneaking into ports around the United States under the cover of darkness and dropping off spies, essentially, who would then take canisters of flu germs and go and let those canisters open in cinemas and shopping centers and in streets and things, right? Like, the Germans are using viruses against us with these flu germ canisters. Now, were they really opening up canisters of flu germs, or were they letting off phosgene gas shells in cinemas and people were getting so-called Spanish flu from that? And this was reported all around the world. Even in Brazil, they reported this. All across Europe, they were reporting this occurring, where the spies were entering into civilian locations and doing this sort of stuff. So it really makes you wonder, yeah, were they flu germs that were being released, or was it something else?
Obviously, the viral particles were catching a ride on the phosgene gas.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's so tragic. If this actually happened, I mean, I can't say for sure that it did. Again, it just seems very coincidental to me. And one thing I will say about the book is I don't try to make any claims. Mm. I just put the information there, and people can make up their own mind, and wherever they sort of want to go with this information, how they put the pieces of the puzzle is really up to them.
Daniel, the last section of your book is titled "The World Is at Stake." What do you mean by that?
Yeah, I think that's the last sub-chapter. Mm-hmm. We have all witnessed firsthand how far south and how quickly south things can go under the false premise and pretenses of protecting people from an infectious germ in the name of public health. We can shut down the world. We can trample on people's rights. We can shut down people's businesses. We can imprison people against their will. We can do all these violations of against humanity and human rights, all in the name of protecting you from an invisible particle that you can't see, that only we can see, and we'll tell you when it's out there, and we're going to tell you how it's going to affect you, and we're going to tell you how you protect yourself, and if you don't protect yourself with how we tell you, well, then we're going to chuck you in prison, or we're going to do other sorts of things to you and restrict you in certain ways. I think what we witnessed in 2020 was just a taste test for things to come. I think that things may get worse in the future if there are more pandemics that happen. We will look back on 2020 with fondness when these other pandemics rear their ugly head and wish that we could be back in 2020 because it was so easy to deal with. I think what we're going to experience in future pandemics is going to be unfathomable. Now, this is all in the name of something which is claimed to be backed and proven scientifically, but actually hasn't. Now, that's problematic because if it hasn't been proven and people don't realize that it hasn't been proven, well, what that means is you can't be forced to do something against your will. It means that your actions don't necessarily mean they're going to hurt somebody else. Like, if you don't wear a mask, you're not going to kill your grandmother or whatever. Like, people think these things have been proven and you better adhere to these rules. Otherwise, you're a risk to public health. If we don't realize that none of this is based in science and logic and reason, and that we don't need to necessarily comply with these requests, which is really all they are, these mandates are just requests. If we don't realize that, the world's going to be a pretty dim place very soon. But if we do realize that, what it means is that there can be two options that people can take when a pandemic rolls around. And the option one is just keep going about living your life how you want to, because this is an unproven hypothesis And if I get sick, it's on me. And people say, well, I choose to believe it. Even though it's not backed in science, I choose to believe it. I will go along with all the measures. But I can't hold anyone who's not doing these measures responsible because it's not proven scientifically. So when unproven scientific things are forced upon people and they trample upon people's human rights, that's a problem. And if we don't realize that, it's going to keep happening into perpetuity forever. I think this is one of the last chances that we will get at being able to speak out and push back against this. If this rolls around again, I think it's going to be much more forceful, and people like us may very well find it very difficult to have any platform to be heard on. Our voices may be restricted to the point where no one hears us and we miss the boat, we miss our chance. So this is what I mean when the world is at stake. This is why I'm doing what I'm doing, why I'm putting this information out there, because I don't want to look back in 5 or 10 years when the world's a very different place and wonder, what if I did something? What if I said something and spoke up? What if I didn't live in fear? Would the world be a different place? And yes, I'm just one man. I'm just one person. I can't change the world, can I? Well, when you look at some of the evidence on things like social contagion, which seems to be a real phenomenon, people acting in certain ways and with certain behaviors and displaying certain emotions, that can spread to other people. So if you're engaging in a happy, joyous life, those around you will also experience the benefits of you being happy and joyous. That will rub off on them. They will become happier and more joyous in their life, and that will spread to other people. So just you, one person, being happier and more joyous could affect thousands of people. So when it's just one person, little old me, just saying one thing, acting one way, acting righteously and without fear, yes, it's impacting my own personal life, but it will also spread via social contagion to other people to act the same way. So if we get enough people doing this, it will spread. And I think this is one of the reasons why people were so heavily censored during the pandemic, was to stop this social contagion effect from actually occurring and blowing the whole thing apart.
Preach. We're right there with you, Daniel. Daniel, who is this book for?
I want to say everybody. I took incredibly complex topics and tried to simplify them down in such a way that anyone can understand it, hopefully. But also wrote it in a way that health professionals can pick this book up and learn something from it that may in fact change their perspective on infectious disease forever. There's over 1,100, I think even closer to 1,400 references. Everything that is said in that book is referenced. Almost like every couple of sentences, there's references there. Nothing is really my opinion. It's all backed up by things that are published in the medical literature or in mainstream newspapers for whatever that's worth. Also, for people who may think that they're sort of across all the terrain stuff and germ theory, one of the men who helped me write or edit this book, Dr. Mark Bailey, when he read it, he said to me, wow, Dan, there's just so much in here that I didn't know, and I've learned so much from editing your book. So like even the most hardened fan or devotee to this sort of terrain movement, I think there's something in there for them as well.
Based on what I've read so far, I agree with everything you just said.
Well, thank you.
Daniel, we're coming to the end. We got to ask you a question that we ask all our guests. What are your non-negotiables, the daily habits that you do to attend to your terrain?
I get out in the sun. I try to get out in the fresh air, but where I am at the moment, there's a lot of burning and things going on, so the air quality is not that good. But outside, in the sun, in the fresh air, around the people that I love and I care about, moving my body, drinking lots of water, eating good food, trying to get as much rest as I can, waking up in the morning and being grateful for having another day in this realm, and trying to enjoy every moment. I can't always do that, but yeah, being thankful, being mindful, observing, being outside in nature and just looking, just observing, that keeps me present, keeps me in the moment, keeps me centered and grounded. I try to take my shoes off as often as possible and put my skin on the earth. I also try to get outside at night when possible, even if just for 5 or 10 minutes, and moon gaze and star gaze. Mm-hmm. We all know about the health benefits of the sun, but no one ever talks about the health benefits of moonlight and starlight. And that's pretty much what I try to do every day. No one's perfect and we can't do it all the time, but yeah, these are the essential things that people need for good health. And I want to try and have as best health I can while I'm here experiencing this journey we call life. And yeah, that's basically my daily routine.
Simple, beautiful, foundational. Daniel, where can the listener learn more about you and your work?
Yeah, the book is available on Amazon at the moment. You can just go to Amazon and type in, "Can you catch a cold?" It will be available on lulu.com. I know there's a lot of people who don't want to purchase through Amazon, and that's fine. Should be available on Lulu in the next couple of weeks. You can also check out my website. It's humanly.com, humanley.com. Got a bunch of podcasts and a free webinar library, and I offer lots of information there for people. I've also got a Telegram channel, which is t.me/humanly. You can jump on there, and we've got a growing community. We've got some pretty good conversations and things happening over there. So that's the best place to contact me.
And folks, get over to his website and check out Daniel's podcast. He's doing an extraordinary job. The website is an extraordinary resource. Guarantee you're gonna learn a ton. Daniel Roydis, thank you for joining us on the Terrain Theory podcast. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks so much, guys. I'm really honored and blessed to have had the opportunity to talk with you. And yeah, thank you so much for having me. And yeah, I wish you guys the best with what you're doing with your podcast and all the work that you're doing as well. Thank you. We are in the after-party, in the pioneer
room. We are in the after-party. It's the after-party in the pioneer room. Dr. Mike.
Dr. Ben, hello.
You can always squirt a little bit out, I think, is the line of the day. That's nice. Folks, after every episode, before we jump into the pioneer room, into the after party, we always have to take a little pee break. Both of us are like, I can just go right out this door, and I tend to, right in nature.
Same.
But now it's at the point where we just do it. We just assume that we have to take one, even if you don't have to. And that was where Mike had the line. You can always squirt a little bit out.
It's true. Yeah. Especially, I live my life on the road. So
yeah,
even if you don't have to go when you're on a 6-hour drive, you might as well go try and squirt a little bit out.
The issue I run into is that this office space is attached to the outside garage, the detached garage. And when I go out this door, I'm facing my road. Hmm. And there does tend to be, even though I'm on a dead end street, the neighbors have a farm and they're like always busy. And I like almost 30% of the time, I start peeing and then like a car comes down the road and I have to do the quick cutoff and then go inside and like pretend like I'm, and that's not good for you, Michael. That doesn't feel good.
So thank you for sharing.
Folks, listen, this is the TMI pineal room. We don't hide anything.
Well, you have my permission to take the 15 steps to the other side of your garage.
And, as I should do.
Don't feel like you have to rush on my account, Ben. You enjoy that.
Thank
that
you.
Moment.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. I appreciate that. Michael, do not order Can You Catch a Cold?
Why not?
Because I'm going to order it for you.
Oh, yeah?
I'm going to send you a copy.
Thanks, librarian.
Redundancies. We need to have redundancies. The librarian franchise. Franchises will exist in the after times. So even as society collapses and people depend on small resources like librarians and welders and plumbers, you can still have franchises in the apocalypse. And this will be one of them.
I was wondering if you wanted to branch out from your librarian enterprise and become a bookseller, you know?
Oh, there you go. Oh, yeah. Oh, that's not a bad idea. So I should stock up on multiple copies.
Certain books.
And just trade in grains of rice and bullets.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Exactly.
That wouldn't be, by the way, folks, it wouldn't be grains of rice, obviously. It would be like organ meat.
Trade knowledge for power.
Knowledge for power. Speaking of knowledge and power, I am excited for you to get your copy. Daniel has done such an extraordinary job. And as he mentioned, so Dr. Mark Bailey, who's been on the show,
to hear that.
Right? Mark and Sam, who are both living legends in this space. Dr. Mark Bailey was basically his editor, like read through the entire thing. And also Samantha Bailey, Mark's wife, writes the foreword for the book. I don't know how much you've listened to his podcast, Daniel's podcast, Humanly, but he just does such a great job. He brings on excellent guests and does such an incredible job teasing out topics and subjects and exploring and building upon the knowledge base within this like terrain space and sort of beyond. It almost feels limiting to just say it's like the terrain space. It's really just like health and human experience space.
Cool. It was not on my radar, so I'll definitely check it out.
Yeah. But he also, you know, as we love folks who are good spokespeople for whatever it is they stand for. And Daniel's one of the best. I mean, in this space, very clearly one of the best.
So you've been following him for some time.
Yeah, I've been, as I told him before we hit record, I've been Daniel aware for a while, and it's long overdue to interact face to face, have him on, and just get a better understanding. The timing is obviously perfect because he's got this book that just released, and you know, hopefully we can get this into the hands of more folks, and even the like folks like right now who are listening, who are interested in these conversations, but maybe haven't started building a library. This would be one I would encourage everyone to get first. Like if you're listening for whatever reason, you're kind of interested and curious in terrain, you're maybe not bought in completely on the idea that pathogenic viruses have never been proven to exist, get this book because Daniel just does a wonderful job of laying it all out there. And as you said, everything is cited. He's got a source for everything and it's digestible. It flows really well. It's logically laid out. It's a handbook.
That's great. How deep into it are you?
As I told him, I, in preparation of this, I did a lot of skipping around just so I had something of a grasp of how the book is laid out and some of the points that he touches on. But I'm just still in part one. So he's got three parts. And if I'm going cover to cover, I'm still in part one. But I've bounced through all the sections. Yeah. And the appendix, as he mentioned, the appendix is actually this, you know, is a third of the book.
Wow.
Is the appendix. Yeah. And that is all the contagion studies, the failed human experiments to prove contagion. He has all of them laid out here and, you know, just a little blurb on each one. And it's that alone is a great resource. So it's been attempted. That's what I think folks don't, that's the other side of the argument that folks don't quite understand. So we can talk about the problems with virus, like viral isolation or virus isolation, the methods that virology uses to prove the existence of viruses and also that they're pathogenic and cause disease. But the flip side of it is there have been experiments on contagion. Like, let's get a sick person in with a healthy person and let's make sure that we're right here. And they fail. They all fail. Contagion has never been proven to exist. And in fact, it's disproven itself at this point. And I think I like that Daniel has put all of these contagion studies into one location. So now you just pick up the book and you can browse to it and be like, oh, here's another example. They've tried it. Actually, yeah, they tried this specifically for influenza. And here's how that worked out.
That is good to know. Just last night, because, you know, in my household, we're navigating this conjunctivitis situation. So Ruth and I were talking about that. You know, I made the case that the pink eye bug isn't jumping from one person to another because they've never proved that fluids from a sick person can make another person sick. But she countered with, well, have they just put healthy people in a room with sick people? And I said, I don't know. That it would be a good idea. Yeah, you're saying
here it is. Like they have. Hundreds of times. Hundreds of times. And yeah. You know, we had Jacob Diaz on to talk about a couple of those studies. We've talked about the Spanish flu studies, a sort of famous Spanish flu studies that were attempted and failed. But Jacob Diaz, the undercover virologist, is his handle on Instagram, has put together like a 10-slide post breaking down some of these studies. You know, folks would rather go to social media to digest some of this stuff. But it's just very comprehensive. It's just a comprehensive dismantling of germ theory, the contagion studies, some of the contagions that happened, and look at it through an alternative lens, and then attempting to answer, starting to answer, provide evidence for the alternative explanations to why contagion appears to exist a certain way and what it really could be.
Yeah, teasing out, I think it comes off as maybe hyperbolic as like a conversation starter to say like contagion doesn't exist, or like, you know, even Cowan's book, The Contagion Myth. Yeah. It's like, it's sort of like a shots fired type of statement to make, but to again bring nuance to the conversation, we're teasing out the multitude of mechanisms of quote unquote contagion. Like Daniel said, it's like once you can write this one off that we've been so steeped in since birth, we can start to explore dozens of other possibilities, which could be filed under the word contagion, but it's useful to know how you go about navigating adaptive responses.
Yeah, adaptive responses.
Yeah.
Right. Right. The need for a different language.
Yeah.
Even the word cure, we hesitate to use. And if you think about it, in one of the hashtags that I'd like to use in social from day one, one was terrain theory and the other one was impeccable terrain. Well, yeah. I don't think there's any such thing. It's like the you can have this goal of arriving at an impeccable terrain, but the realities of living in the modern world are that you are always being exposed to things. The goal is always homeostasis. Like nature is always trying to arrive at balance, but that's not how it works. There's never actual homeostasis, right? You're always going to have an influx of something. Something's going to adjust and then balance that out a little bit. And the goal is homeostasis, but I don't think you ever fully achieve it. And maybe you do for a microsecond and then, you know, things are out of whack again. But the goal in health, like how we support our body trying to arrive at homeostasis, is to remove those blockades or blockages, those things that are hindering our body arriving at homeostasis or healing itself. But like a cure, there is no cure. Like you're never cured fully of the exposure to the toxins in our environment. That's not, I don't think that's how it works.
Yeah, not in the times that we're living in. We're just so inundated.
Yeah, and your body does not adapt. I don't say, all right, I've arrived. I've fully adapted now. That's not true. You're consistently exposed to additional stimuli to which you have to adapt. You are constantly in the mode of adaptation. Hmm. How well you adapt can be determined by all these other various factors and how well you take care of yourself, your lifestyle, nutrition, mindset, so on and so forth. You're always going to adapt. Some are just going to do so well. Mm-hmm. Some are going to do so poorly. And then some might not.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know if this acronym holds water, but I quite liked for God, which is another word I don't love, speaking of semantics and language, but generate, operate, and degenerate is the process, which there's sort of what you were just saying. It's like you're in this constant process of regenerating and degenerating. Correct. And in the middle, hopefully operating.
Yeah. Yes. And the more effectively and efficiently you can do that and allow your body to do that, the healthier you will be, the healthier you will feel, the better your body will feel, the better you will sleep, the more focused and attentive and energetic you are. Like, that's ultimately
the
goal.
the cognitive piece is a big one. I listened to a great conversation with some of our heroes that was part of the end of COVID, a conversation around esoteric biochemistry with Steve Falconer, Amanda Vollmer, Bear Lando, and it was moderated by Don Lester. And they made the point that because of what we're talking about, because of the onslaught of toxins that we're constantly having to navigate, we're spending so much energy just to sort of like parry those blows that it's hard for us to get to that next level of a cognitive jump because we're spending so much energy just trying to keep the physical machine in order.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
And when you look at it, sort of the spiritual warfare side of this odyssey, that makes a lot of sense that they would keep batting us down physically so we're not able to sort of ascend mentally.
Yeah, it's like trying to climb the castle wall. You know, you're trying to lay siege to the castle, the top being like ultimate thriving, and you're having a hot tar and arrows shot down at you constantly. You're not going to make any progress.
Correct.
Yeah.
One thing, while we're just talking about words and semantics, it is interesting to think about, and maybe should have taken the opportunity to ask Daniel. You know, he mentioned St. John's Wort, and you mentioned the story of the homeopath whose whole business model is predicated on treating people with antivirals. And is there a semantic art? I mean, okay, viruses don't exist, but if what we're calling viruses is just the cytopathic effect of cell death or just like tissue decline, or as we just said, degeneration, is there a mechanism where some of these herbs are aiding or slowing down the degeneration or helping to repair quicker? Is it the same functionality just with different language?
That's a great question. I think, is the herb facilitating the body's natural healing responses, or is it only addressing the symptom and actually impinging?
Right.
And for the long term,
Is it symptom suppression or is it actually?
And that's what you would have to. That's what you would have to determine with, I guess, each of those quote unquote antivirals. Okay, what is it actually doing? Is it actually having a positive impact? But the mechanism is misunderstood, or is it just a symptom suppressant? In which case, you would want to remove it completely.
Where it's like it's acting more like an antibiotic.
Right.
Right. These are good. It's funny. It's really interesting I dove back into homeopathy just yesterday. I grabbed the Lisa Strabak book off my bedside table and I brought it to the health food store with me last night, and sort of fun because Willie was driving and he's like, what's that? He actually asked, what's that book? I was like, oh, I'm glad you asked. So it says right in the back, conjunctivitis, and here's the, 10 different remedies that we can try. And they had a bunch of them at the health food store, which was great. The last time I reached for that book was when Will was having some night terrors, actually, which were really, unsettling. And there were, of course, a few in there that were recommended, but they did not have them at the local store. As sort of an aside, they had some, one of which is Belladonna. But anyway, last night they had a lot of them. And it's because Eugenie Kruger had sent us those kits, which was so sweet of her. I'd sort of been leaning on that one because it does cover sort of a wide swath. One of which is Apis, which is a remedy derived from the stinger of a bee, the venom. And I do think that helped take the swelling down in my eyes because that's what it's purported to help do. So I'd taken the Apis. I was like, okay, well, what else can I get into? So I went and I got some Thuja, and I'm going to forget the names because some of them were sort of beyond me. Belladonna was on the list. Euphrasia, I believe. And one that starts with a P-U-L, like Pulsaria or something like that. So I'm exploring that world again. But it is funny to simultaneously, I feel like what virology did is they bogarted the science homeopathy. Because we've talked about this before.
Yeah.
And it is really funny trying to explain how homeopathy works to my son. You know, I'm reading it. The book is so great. I'm reading it from the book and how it's based in physics and not in chemistry. And it's more of an energetic imprint and succussing and the whole science of it. Because the funny thing is, Willie's in public school. So he's getting like the public school education. And he's also really good at it. Like he really quote unquote loves science. And he's like thriving in that subject, which... I'm doing my best not to like squash his success, but also sort of offer a counter narrative or counter education. And the older he gets, like with each month, I feel like he's a little bit more receptive to it. But it is funny because the mechanism of homeopathy is essentially what they're selling vaccinology to us as.
In a sense, right? The poison is the cure.
Yeah, just give a little bit.
A weakened version of the poison and your body will have an immunity to it. Yeah. And it's a bastardized bogarting of it, I suppose. So what you're saying, though, is I should send two copies of Can You Catch a Cold to West Hurley.
You read my mind.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I do like to have extra copies of stuff on hand because it's great to give people books. But yeah, you don't have to send me two. You don't have to send me. I mean, if there's one in the house, I'm going to find my moment to impart some of these books to the family. But that seems like a good one, is what you're saying.
Potentially.
Yeah.
I think there's a lot of fun. There's a lot of fun. There's exciting and very interesting. I mean, to me, the whole thing is interesting. But I'm trying to imagine through the eyes of a teen.
Yeah, right.
There's a lot of interesting alternative explanations for things that if he's got an open enough mind, he'd be like, oh, I'd never heard that before. Because sometimes, you think about being a teenager and coming to the table with cool fun facts.
Yeah.
Like here's a fun fact for you. And if it's grounded in science.
Well, that's the thing about Will is that he loves he's
a fun fact guy.
Oh yeah, and he likes to sort of be the smartest guy in the room, and he likes to debunk shit.
Yeah.
So I feel like that'll work. That could really work in my favor eventually. It's like, you want to get into debunking, brother?
Maybe.
But how about so Daniel, was reprimanded and eventually had to step down from his teaching position. It seems like there's an opportunity here for a terrain theory university.
Well, he's got some great. He has. Some awesome webinars and workshops on his
site. That's really what it is. Yeah.
Yeah. And he's gone in that direction. He's got a great body of knowledge that's been built up, a lot of which is free. And then some he has behind like a member sort of member our access paywall.
Yeah.
Andrew Kaufman has similar. I mean, Tom Cowan has the new biology. So
Amanda Walmer as well.
Yeah. And so everyone's kind of doing their own thing in this space. There is an opportunity for an actual, somewhat more centralized,
like a brick and mortar.
Either that or like, let's bring everything together. It's funny because then you think, okay, how do we determine who's the authority?
Yeah.
And what makes it in? And then you're down this pathway of, well, now there's a body that's the authority on this that gets to decide what is and isn't considered part of the terrain conversation.
Yeah.
That, but you know, it. I like the way you're thinking. I always like the way your head works. What was your idea that you had this morning, which was ridiculous?
Okay. Oh, the Astro Cafe.
Yeah. Well, I don't even know if I'm going to let that one stay on this.
You might want to edit that out. Yeah.
Or you know what? Let's just hand it out there to the universe. Go ahead.
Oh, well, okay. So I really am loving my exploration of esoteric biochemistry. As you know, I just listened to that recent episode that I just mentioned. And it's like, if you want to sort of hold people's hands or make this like readily accessible to the public, what if there was a bar / cafe that isn't serving alcohol and caffeine drinks, or maybe they sell those too. I don't fucking know. But is tailoring beverages and plates, I guess, to your natal chart, star, as your esoteric biochemic imprint, right? So providing those nutrients that you're lacking in from when you were born.
Yeah.
And then your the menu is comprised of like a zodiac and where you fall in it. And if you were preemie, you should have more of, you know, all this. Yeah.
So you get countering the deficiency. You sort of get like screened. You have an initial screening. You'd have to have an initial screening of some sort to determine.
You wouldn't even need to. It's just, when is your birthday?
Yeah. Yeah.
And were you a preemie?
But now you're like, you're kind of in their system. You walk in, they're like, oh yeah, okay, here you are. We already have you in the database. Here's what we recommend. You almost have like a tailored suggested menu for that day. And maybe it changes if it's like around your lunar return. I don't know enough around the esoteric biochemistry. So the Astro Cafe.
Oh, your lunar return. Man. All you get water.
That's it. Yeah, you get water. Man. Michael. Here's the franchise. This is the franchise. The Astro Cafe.
Mm-hmm.
I love you and your antenna.
Well, how do we, the whole idea is like, how do you bring these ideas to the public?
Totally.
Like, how do you present them and normalize them? Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Yep.
Yeah.
And on every table in the Astro Cafe is a copy of Can You Catch a Cold?
There would be a badass bookshelf in the Astro Cafe.
There will.
Well, again, as I travel around, Ben, it's like, there must be demand more so than just than me and my family for like some sort of like more whole food organic based options for food on the road.
Yeah.
Like, why is it only, we
I thought this, and... I thought this for airports. Like one of my ideas was there needs to be an organic, like salad buffet type offering at every airport. All your airport food offerings are garbage.
Yeah.
And even like the juice bar is all garbage and sugar and crap. Like if you had one place you could go that it was, hey, this is all organic and non-GMO.
And you can get like, it seems self-evident to me. Exactly. Right?
You would make a killing because that is what you think is in high demand. Maybe it's not in as high demand as we think, but I think it is.
Or maybe there are forces at play that
are there, Michael.
Keep that off the playing field.
Are there?
I don't know.
Yeah, I do. Feels like it. It feels like they are. Well, okay, we're coming up near the end. This is one of the last episodes we'll record before the solar eclipse, which I believe, are you in the path of totality?
No.
Okay, you're not far from it.
No. In fact, again, my son is making plans with his girlfriend who's heading up to Vermont, which I imagine, actually Jericho, where you used to live.
Yep.
To potentially be part of that.
What do you know how much of the eclipse you're going to see? What percentage?
I haven't looked. I've decided to take no interest in it.
You're probably like a 95%. Yeah. You're not.
Yeah, I don't know.
100
I don't
know. Like me, but
but are you going to go look at it?
Oh yeah, see, I mean, I'm just going to be right here.
My whole thing is like
I got my glasses.
Maybe I've been listening to too much Howdy McCoskey, but I'm like, I'm more interested in like lighting a candle and staring at that. Oh, right,
keeping a light alive.
Yeah.
I'm turning away from him specifically as a voice because none of it resonates with me. It just not enough of it resonates with me. It's a little too dark.
It is dark.
I think he's just chosen that path. He's gone down that path and, you know, good for him. He's got an audience. People are going to gravitate towards it. Yeah. I see the eclipse. Maybe it is a moment of literal and figurative darkness for the world. Maybe we're not meant to look at it. Maybe I've got 4 days to devour whatever reading I can to decide one way or another, but I'm not looking at it as like a bad thing.
Yeah.
I'm just not. I think it's a natural phenomenon that will only happen a couple times, you know, a few times in your life, and I'm going to make the most of it. My kid's going to make the most of it. And maybe I'll have a little bonfire going, just, you know, why not?
Yeah.
Why not cover that base? But I've got glasses. I'm going to look at that thing. In fact, I might take the glasses off and just stare right at it. I've been doing a lot of sun gazing in the mornings, and I feel all the better for it.
Yeah, yeah. No, I'm not scared of it, but I also like to like sort of buck the trends also. And as it turns out, I was just updating my calendar with my pencil yesterday, and I have a chiropractor appointment that day, April 8th, at 3:30, which isn't the eclipse like at 3:33 or something?
You're not going.
I am.
You're not? Okay. Okay.
I'm going. Okay. I'm going to bring my candle. I'm bring my candle to
you're
the
gonna
chiropractor.
Be, you're going to be inside getting your back adjusted while the eclipse is happening.
Correct.
You're not worried about the dark spirits getting in between the cracks of your spine no, during that time of darkness?
That's why I'm bringing the candle.
They will be warded off by the beeswax candle.
Yeah, exactly.
Turns out that's all you need, people. I think that's awesome, man. I think the other thing is,
I guess there's something thrilling about going to look at it, but also just like sort of like knowing that it's going on and like just sort of connecting in a non-physical way to the phenomenon.
Cool. You know? I can't wait to hear back how that appointment, maybe that appointment's going to be like incredible, right? Why not? Why not go into it thinking that?
Yeah.
I'm not going at, there's so many like theories about what's going to happen, and so much of it is just dark.
Well, there's a lot of weird, you know, CERN is firing up
all
for the first time in 2 years, and NASA's firing rockets named after demonic Egyptian entities. It's like, what the actual fuck?
And there's never going to be a shortage of that. What I will wait for on April 9th, starting April 9th, is for all these folks who've made doom and gloom predictions to come forward publicly and apologize and say that they were wrong. And I will not hold my breath while I wait for that, because they never do it. They just move on to the next one. Right? They just move on to the next one. So I'm done. I can't. I'm going to look at it as like this beautiful natural phenomenon that maybe is positive in some way. Unless in the next 4 days you send me something that changes my mind. And then I'm stocking up on candles.
No, I'll try to refrain.
Love it. Folks, nothing you heard here should be taken as medical advice. Neither Mike nor I are medical experts. Remember that you are light. You are love. You can change the world. You are your primary healthcare provider. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll catch you on the next one.